Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to the Psychology Forum. Really delighted to have Dr. Jeffrey Yeager speak for us tonight. It's a subject that's very important. I've been through unemployment in the past. I know how difficult it can be. Dr. Yeager earned his bachelor's degree in psychology, and he also has a master's degree of divinity with a special focus on theology and organizational performance. He received his Ph.D. in Leadership Studies from Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, Catholic University, I believe, right? He has spent 22 years working in senior leadership positions in large nonprofit sectarian organizations. And in 2006, he moved full-time into academia. He joined Golden Gate University in August 2011 and teaches both undergraduate and graduate courses, also serving as the chair of the Undergraduate Management Department. He is a principal for Integral Leadership Consulting, a firm that specializes in leadership training, executive coaching, diversity training, and change management. He is also actively engaged in publishing book reviews and original research addressing coaching, the stresses of not enough employment, the psychological trauma related to the experience of voluntary job loss as well. I'm really delighted that Dr. Yeager agreed to speak for us tonight, so please welcome Dr. Yeager. And following Dr. Yeager's talk, there's a microphone set up right here. If you have any questions for him, he tells me he'll be very happy to answer them. Okay.
Thank you, Patrick. Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you're well. Hope your day's gone well. I have a few people to thank, first of all. There's a number of people here from Golden Gate University, and it is a delight to see you here, colleagues and friends. And it's a thrill to be able to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart. I want to thank, in particular, Patrick for the opportunity to be here. So, Patrick O'Reilly, thank you. And by the way, Gonzaga is Jesuit. I guess you could say still Catholic, but Jesuit is the differentiator there. So, I mean, love the Jesuits. You got to love the Jesuits. Better still, thank you. I also want to recognize Michael Nolan. Where's Michael? Michael's right here. Michael, raise your hand. Michael is a good friend and a member here at the Commonwealth Club and first introduced me to Patrick. So, Michael, thank you very much. Michael's a good friend and been a good coach for some time. I also want to recognize my wife, Krista Moses Yergler, who's sitting in the back next to my mom, and Krista's parents, Daryl and Donna. So delighted that you're here. This is a topic that is terribly complex, and I don't even attempt to try to cover it in detail. The whole nature of the psychological impact of unemployment is complex, and I'm going to be looking at it from a very specific slice that I will try to clarify in just a moment. But that's just kind of a disclaimer to let you know that as we go through this, it's certainly not all there is to say about the psychological impact of unemployment. And I know that, as Patrick said, as he said himself, many of us in this room have experienced a season of unemployment. And everybody experiences unemployment differently. Would you not agree with me? Some people do fine. They cope well, they have plenty of resources to get through it, and they don't skip a beat. However, others experience the impact of unemployment quite differently. So as Patrick also said, that as we move through this, if you have a question that you'd like to ask, I think Patrick will have, 10 or 15 minutes, and he has the cane, so when he says, time's up, and we'll be done. But please, if you have a question, formulate that, and by all means, when we're done, I'd love to entertain your questions. So let's get into this. Let's get busy. I first began to study the psychological impact of unemployment, more specifically, involuntary job loss. And the kind that I'm talking about is where someone's laid off against their will. They want to work, but they're told you're fired, you're laid off, as opposed to people who voluntarily leave because they hate their boss. So I'm going to leave my job and move on. We're not talking about those folk, but we're focusing instead on those who want to work, desperately need to work, but are told they're no longer wanted. So back in 2006, I really began to hone in on this as part of some doctoral research. And what I did was interviewed in depth what we call qualitative phenomenological investigation, where I sat down with the five senior executives who had been laid off. And you're going to be hearing some of their responses all the way through this, because I've pulled snippets of my interviews with them. Of course, all anonymous. You won't be able to know who they are because they're all up in the Northwest. They're not around here. So you will hear firsthand from them what they experienced from the perspective of job loss and the trauma of that. What I found was that these men and women all experienced job loss differently, but many of them were traumatized by the event. So that led me down a path of looking at job loss from a traumatic perspective. So someone is traumatized by their job loss. So the whole notion of trauma and understanding what trauma does to the human mind and the way it changes the way someone thinks and the way someone sees reality is really where I went with this. So these five in-depth interviews opened doors for me that led to deeper and deeper questions about the experience of job loss. The more I read about job loss, the more that I read scholars and researchers call it traumatic, very few people would describe what was meant by the word trauma or traumatic. And so this presentation really is a time to describe what it was like for these men and women and others that I've investigated over the years to experience the trauma that can result from job loss. So that began in 2006. 2008 up to the present, much of my own research has been focused around understanding psychological trauma as it relates to the experience of job loss. And that really has shaped my own life. I think some of the best research is research that, in a sense, shapes you. So the questions that you're asking about, the experiences of life, how to understand yourself better, how to deepen your self-awareness because of difficult experiences, is some of the best internal work that we'll ever do. Hard, indeed, sometimes we need help to get through that. I know there have been seasons of my life where I've needed to sit down with a professional and say, look, how do I deal with this loss? And that's just fine. In fact, I think it's the better part of valor when we sit down with someone who knows way more than we do about our emotions and our experiences and helps us understand it better. So to set the stage, that's by way of introduction. To set the stage, let's get into some economic numbers. What I'm going to do is kind of move from the macro down to the micro. Now, there's probably some folks in here that are thinking about now, oh my goodness, economic data. I did not pay $20 to be briefed on economic data. Well, this will help us understand, kind of put in context the conversation of the experience of job loss. So this is just a bit of data. The June unemployment rate, as reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, stood at 8.3%, just ticked up a bit from 8.2. So we have 8.3% unemployment. That represents 12.8 million people. 5.2 million people are among what we call the long-term unemployed. You familiar with that term? Long-term unemployed, which means they've been looking for work for 27 weeks or longer. And this group represents about 40.7% of total unemployment. Now, not counted in that 12.8 million total are an additional 2.5 million persons who are what we call marginally attached to the labor force. These are people who want to work, they're eager to work, they've been looking for work, but they haven't been counted in the total because they haven't been looking for work in the previous 4 weeks when the BLS was gathering its data. When you add in the underemployed, the number goes from about 15 million up to about 20 million people. 20 million people. Some of you have heard, no doubt, of the expression gross domestic product, or GDP. Now, let's just talk a little bit about GDP. Hang in here with me a little bit longer. We're going to get to the meat and potatoes shortly, but this is by way of introduction. GDP is an important part of understanding how employment and unemployment works. Gross domestic product, or GDP, is the market value of all goods and services produced within a country in a given period of time. U.S. GDP has historically averaged, what, around 2.5% to 3% per year? And it's considered one of the leading indicators of the health of the nation's economy. So that's why you'll always hear the new predictions, the predictions for GDP and actual GDP, because we're hanging on our the edge of our seats trying to understand and get the data of what that's going to say about our economy. U.S. GDP for the second quarter this year was 1.5%, down from 2.0% in the first quarter and down from 4% in the fourth quarter of 2011. And the expectations among economists are that there will be little change in GDP for the rest of the year. Now, why is this significant? GDP is significant because a growth rate below 2% is not enough to lower the unemployment rate. Annual economic growth of 2.5 to 3% is needed just to keep up with job growth, new entrants into the job market. And if you want to put a dent in the unemployment rate, GDP needs to be around 4%. We're far from that. Simply put, and you can find this for yourself if you research it on your own, the economy is not growing fast enough to lower the unemployment rate, at least not yet, and it's not predicted to do so for some time. Another indicator of the health of the economy are first-time claims for unemployment insurance. This is the report that comes out when? The first Thursday of every month. By the way, when does the unemployment report come out every month? Anybody know that? Last Friday, which is the first Friday. It wasn't last Friday. I guess it was a couple of weeks ago. The first Friday of every month, that's when you want to listen to the data for the unemployment information. First-time claims for unemployment insurance comes out each Thursday. The report from Thursday, August 16th, showed the moving average had fallen to 363,000 applications. Now, that's good news, believe it or not. When applications fall consistently below 375,000, it generally suggests that hiring is strong enough to lower the unemployment rate. So that's some good news. That's really good news. We see a little bit of traction in our economy, but we are not seeing enough to lower the unemployment rate, which is concerning. Some other labor market trends that need to be mentioned here. The financial crisis in the European Union. Some of you have been following that. As reported by the Department of Commerce in the fall of 2011, approximately 19% of U.S. exports are transacted within the Eurozone. Unemployment in the Eurozone recently rose to a record of 11.1%, as reported in the New York Times recently in July. Just be glad you don't live in Spain, folks. You know what the unemployment rate is in Spain? Not quite 30%. Probably is if you gathered all the data. It's about 25%. It's no wonder that in Spain, as in other places in the Euro, we see a great deal of rioting and civil and social unrest. There's good reason for that. And also, if you did live in Spain, be glad that you are not between the ages of 26 and 16. Do you know what the unemployment rate is for the youth in Spain? 52%. A little bit closer to home. Employers here seem to be refusing to hire in many respects. Why? Well, I think one key driver is the fiscal cliff and the potential tax liabilities that includes. It was reported in the New York Times August 5th, and I quote, "A rising number of manufacturers are canceling new investments and putting off new hires because they fear paralysis in Washington will force hundreds of billions in tax increases and budget cuts in January, undermining economic growth in the coming months." Folks, this is a very difficult employment market. Beyond the numbers, beyond the data, I think it's easy to get the sense, and we don't want to be fatalists here, and I'm certainly not a fatalist, and I'm an optimist, but I truly look at our economy in the way that it's either generating or not generating jobs, and I am concerned. I'm concerned for the well-being of men and women who want to work, can't find work. For whatever reasons, be they what they are, people want to work and they can't find work. So let's talk about trauma. What is trauma? What is psychological trauma? Now, this is going to move us a little bit closer to our goal of understanding about the psychological impact of unemployment, of involuntary job loss. We have some more chairs. Come on up. Doesn't matter. It's fine.
I thought it was 6 o'clock.
Yeah. You can just close this. You can close my lecture here in a few minutes. All right. That's welcome. Please come on down. I'm going to, as I give you these definitions, I'm just going to give you, I also have to include the names of the researchers who put this together. By the way, I've prepared a bibliography for you. So following the presentation today, if you want to do some more follow-up research on psychological trauma and experiences related to stress management, et cetera, there's two pages of data and information there that you may find helpful. Okay. Perlman and McCann. These are two researchers that I've used extensively to help give me a better idea of psychological trauma. So those two scholars basically said this, that psychological trauma is a trauma if the event is sudden, if it is unexpected, or if it's non-normative. Now, let me just stop here a moment and say, as I go through this, I really want you to be thinking not only about the issue of unemployment and the crisis of unemployment and what that does to people psychologically, but I'd like you to think about your own life as well. My sense would be that there are a fair number of people in this room who've experienced a trauma, who've been psychologically traumatized. It could be anything as devastating as rape, a violent assault, a near-death experience, a divorce, tragic divorce, a death of a loved one. And if you can call that experience to mind now, I think in some ways it will make sense as I describe to you an experience of trauma that may be very familiar to you. So an event is psychologically traumatic if it is sudden, unexpected, or non-normative. If it exceeds the individual's perceived ability to meet its demands or control the outcome, which means you can't cope with it. It's just too much for you. It is overwhelming to you. And it disrupts your frame of reference and related schemas. Now, we're going to be getting to frames of reference and schemas here in just a minute. But basically, it's another way of saying the world that you thought you understood, you now no longer understand. Let me say that again. The world you thought you understood, you now no longer understand. Another couple of scholars by the name of Tedeschi and Calhoun define psychological trauma as such. Circumstances that significantly challenge or invalidate important components of the individual's assumptive world, which is another way of saying the very foundations that you've based your life upon now have crumbled. And you have no idea about how to respond, how to interact with a world that you neither understand and you certainly cannot control. Something has happened to you that has totally undone you. You have no armor. You have no material to fight back with. You are vulnerable. You are frightened. You are anxious. Both Perlman and McCann, as well as Tedeschi and Calhoun, as pairs of researchers, talked about loss of fundamental assumptions. And this is where we can better understand how important work is to us. Each of us in this room, we operate with a set of fundamental assumptions or frames of reference that act as overarching internal guides or constructs about the way the world is to be experienced. We know what to expect in the present and the future because of what we've already been through in the past. And these assumptions help us to order our world. For example, one of the reasons that you're all comfortable now in this room is why? Well, I'm assuming you're comfortable. You may feel like it's time to bolt for the door, but not yet. You are comfortable right now, probably because you know what to expect. True? And how do you know what to expect? Because you've been in an environment like this before, not maybe at the Commonwealth Club, this prestigious place that really does amazing work, but you know what it's kind of like to sit down and listen to someone talk about something in a more formal environment, and you know that people behave a certain way, and you know that they act a certain way, and you know you're going to interact with people a certain way. That's how you know how to respond. That's why you're comfortable here. Now, if I got up on top of this podium, stood on my head and gave a lecture on the psychological trauma of unemployment, you wouldn't feel very comfortable, would you? And you wouldn't, because that doesn't fit with the norm of what should happen. Well, it's maybe a silly metaphor, silly illustration, but the point is well made. We live our life based on these assumptions, these frames of reference that help us to know how to act. And we're not even aware that they're functioning. You aren't even aware that you know how to act until I said that you all know how to act. You're comfortable in this environment. That is a fundamental assumption. You know what to do and you know what to expect because you've done it 1,000 times before, and you've established an unconscious routine that gives you great comfort. This is not strange to you. We call that a fundamental assumption. We know how things operate, and we're comfortable operating in them. These frames of reference, these fundamental assumptions, give us a sense of stability and order. They are conservative, which means that we fight really hard to keep them from being changed. That's a really good argument for understanding why change is so difficult in general. We resist change because we don't want our routines and our order and our predictability to be messed with. And if you really want to get someone angry, press on their assumptions, question their values. That's why politics is a lightning rod for conflict. Sex is a lightning rod for conflict. Money, power, name it. Because those strike deeply at our core values or our fundamental assumptions. I'll talk with you. But the moment you begin to question the very pillars that I've built my life upon, that's where the conversation stops. A researcher by the name of Ronnie Janoff Bullman identified basically 3 fundamental assumptions that we all have, more or less. Number 1 would be that we see the world as benevolent and good. We believe people that are kind, they demonstrate goodness, they're helpful, and they care. We believe that good fortune and positive outcomes outnumber misfortunate and negative outcomes. And regardless of the fact that we may see larger problems impacting the nation and the world, people tend to remain optimistic about their own lives. The world may be going to hell in a handbag, but my life, I'm okay. You know, things are good with me. I'm optimistic about my future, my life, and what's in my own backyard. So I believe that the world is benevolent and good. That's assumption number 1. Assumption number 2 is that the world is meaningful. People get what they deserve. If you behave badly, what will you get? You will receive badly. That's not good grammar, I know, but the notion of this just rewards, if I behave this way, I'll get that. So if I behave in a way that says I care about the world, I care about people, good things will happen to me. Come on, we got a couple more seats up here. Really, come on up. It's fine. So we tend to be optimistic. We believe the world is benevolent and good. Assumption number 2, the world is meaningful. It makes sense. if we sow good deeds and we will reap good deeds, and where people are mean and nasty and they do evil things, they will get their just reward. We believe in a just world, a world where people receive what they deserve and deserve what they actually receive. And if we, all of us, do the right things, we engage in proper preventative behaviors, we will be protected from negative events. And further, if we participate in beneficial, ennobling behaviors, good things will happen to us. I mean, my mom, who's here today, taught me to be a good boy. Well, you know, some of that paid off, Mom. So, Seriously, I grew up in a home, as many of you did, all of you did, of you kind of get an idea of what to do right and what to avoid. Well, we don't always do those things, though we may know better or want to do better. Nonetheless, there's a mindset that says, look, if I try to hitch my bet and do the right thing, good things will happen to me. So what happens when you try to do all the right things and bad things happen? What happens when you try to hedge your bet, make the right decisions, go to school, get your degree, know you're going to be hired, and no one hires you? Or worse yet, you're laid off. You're told no one wants you. The third assumption is that the self is worthy. This is probably something that strikes deeply with most of us. The self is worthy. People perceive themselves as good, capable, and moral. I'm a good person. I'm a moral human being. And I have good self-esteem. A psychological trauma results when an event gives you an information that indicates that everything you believed in and based your life upon is not only called into question, but may no longer be true. You've lived a good life, and you experienced a rape. You've tried to be careful, and you are a victim of violent robbery. You've worked hard to be a self-supporting individual, and you're laid off. You're told no one wants you, by the way. When events are interpreted as traumatic, they undermine the very foundations that we live with, that the world is good, the world is just, and that the self is good. I'm okay. People like me, don't they? I have esteem, at least I thought I did. And these assumptions, when they're exposed as illusory, they can undermine the way we even see reality or the way that we cope. For example, I grew up in a home where I was told that getting my education was a non-negotiable. And as I entered the educational system, as many of you have, you kind of realize that doors open to you the more education you have. You see those bar graphs, right? They say the more education you have, the greater the likelihood that you'll get a good-paying job and you'll have this much income. Employers will want you. In fact, they'll engage in a bidding war to get your talent. If you do it right, you go to the right school, like Gonzaga, or Golden Gate University, or Stanford, or Cal, it doesn't matter. You are in a system that says if you do A, you'll get B. Well, it does make sense. At least it did for a while. That no longer holds true. Get your education indeed, but it doesn't mean that anybody's going to want you. Well, let's move from fundamental assumptions to the real nitty-gritty of today's talk. And that is understanding these, what we call schemas. Schemas are these internal grids or mental models that tell us what to expect from experience. When experiences are aligned with our internal expectations, we function really well. I mean, if you behave the way you're supposed to behave today, then I'll feel really good. If any of you misbehave, if John, for example, here would stand on his chair and start throwing things at me, that would be disruptive to me. Don't get any ideas, John, please. So when our experiences align with what we expect, we do fine. And even when data that's coming into us does not fit what we think should happen, you know what we tend to do? We bend it and shape it so it fits. This may be what's really going on, but this is the way that I'm going to see it. This is the way that I'm going to absorb it into my world. So it may be contradictory what's happening out here, but nonetheless, I'm going to press on with my belief and my conviction and what I know to be true. Traumatic experiences send data to our internal grids that overwhelm the internal schemas. That when the data that comes into us doesn't fit with what we believe, it's easy to begin to lose our bearings. We begin to be paralyzed, as it were. Being forced to deal with this data can be overwhelming. Traumatic experiences invite us. This is key. Traumatic experiences or events that are interpreted as traumatic, which means they overwhelm our ability to cope and understand them, they are invitations to change. They are invitations to grow. They are invitations to be different, to see life differently, to see relationships differently, to see the self differently. This is very difficult, but it's very possible. When we are unable to rebuild our schemas, which means when we are unable to get the data that the world is sending us and find a way to incorporate that in the way we see other people, the employment, workplace, relationships, it really makes us less competent and less capable. We're not able to redefine our world, and we are vulnerable to, and this is a longer subject, but post-traumatic stress disorder really is a chronic condition of an individual who's not able to adjust to new data. And it continually overwhelms their ability to see relationships, to see safety, fearing many things, and not being able to settle in. I've had students over the years who suffer from PTSD, and they would come up to me in the beginning of class, and they would tell me, "Jeff, I've got PTSD. Just want to let you know. I'll be sitting in the back of the room by the door." And they do. And sometimes, and I was forewarned that they would leave in the middle of class because they didn't feel safe. A schema is a mental structure that represents the way we organize knowledge about a type of experience. It's the way we build our reality. You're all operating with schemas this very moment. And research on trauma, psychological trauma, has zeroed in on these five schemas, and I'll move through them quickly because I'm aware of our time. I have about 14 minutes left. 19. All right. Patrick, you're a good man. Thank you. So when we talk about the schemas that are affected, so we've moved from frames of reference, the way we kind of see big picture of the world around us. Now we're looking at particular schemas, that the things that allow us to operate every day. Researchers on psychological trauma have narrowed down five particular schemas that, if they're damaged or disrupted, can do significant, can change significantly the way we see ourselves as workers and certainly see the employment environment. So schema number one, this is what we call the safety schema. Safety. It's the belief that I am safe and I can protect myself from harm. I can take the necessary precautions and shield myself from a dangerous and unpredictable world. With job loss, you now have credible threats to your home, your property, your loved ones. There's no safe place, and one is exposed to harm in the present and inevitable harm in the future. One is anxious. They can be anxious when they lose their job. Activities are restricted. They slow down. They shut down. People are hypervigilant. They're reactive. They worry over their own well-being and safety. They are concerned about being victimized or harmed by another individual or employer. How can I trust my boss ever again or another boss? They feel vulnerable and exposed. They are concerned about the safety of the people they love. For example, listen to Scott, 77 years old, who was laid off from his job as a nonprofit executive director. Quote, "There was a whole lot of outbursts of anger, frustration. Where do we go from here? How can we possibly survive this? There were moments of tremendous fear. Can I make it? Can I do anything? My first reaction was, oh my God, how do I tell my wife? My wife manages the funds in our home, pays the bills, keeps track of our financial situation. She is a very emotional person. It was a major impact for her, and that impacted on me because she had numerous cases of what I would call meltdowns, significant meltdowns. She would kick the walls, scream at the top of her voice, yell, curse, talk about killing my boss. She would say, how can I make him suffer? What can we do? In the past, he had colon cancer several years ago, survived that, came back fine, and shortly, only about a year ago, ended up in the hospital with a heart bypass. Her comment was, how can he have his life saved twice just so he can ruin ours? Safety schema, falling apart, feeling vulnerable, perhaps. Schema number two is what we call the trust schema. The belief here is that other people can be relied upon to provide support. I have meaningful relationships with good friends who are available, helpful, and encouraging. With job loss, it can undermine trust, can it not? Trust in interpersonal relationships could be shattered. This is often the hallmark of psychological trauma, damage to relationships. This includes feeling of being abandoned, betrayal, broken promises, and extreme unresponsiveness to normal dependency, which means I can't be in a relationship really with anybody because I feel insecure. I don't feel like I can trust you. No one. When significant people violate trust, it undoes trust across the board. It's not just contained oftentimes in that one relationship. The quote from Eric, 55 years old, a controller in a large organization, said this: "The day that I left, nobody, not even the senior management of which I was a part, came to say goodbye, good luck, or anything else. I had to, on my own initiative, carry my stuff out to the car. No one was there. It was the loneliest person. That was the loneliest feeling in the world. I felt like no one was there for me." And then here's Pete, 53 years old, the vice president of operations in a large business. He said, "I mean, you realize that even when all of it's said and done, the owner of a company or a larger corporation, they're in it for themselves, and you better be in it for yourself. They are going to throw pitches at your head. They're going to come in cleats up when they slide into second base. This kind of job loss really sears it into your brain because you realize here that these people are lying to you. They say, oh, you're doing a great job, this, that, and the other thing, and you're our top guy. And oh, by the way, we fell in love with somebody else. And so you're going to have to take your stuff and go home." The third schema that oftentimes is disrupted with job loss is the esteem schema. The belief here is that I have worth and value. I understand and know myself. I have hope and believe in my potential. If you have ever been laid off, if there's one area of life that truly struggles, it oftentimes is esteem. Feeling that you're worthy, feeling that you have any value. With job loss, it is an experience that communicates degradation, humiliation, rejection, or devaluation. And there are what we call also second injuries. If you have someone in your life who has been laid off and they're unemployed, be careful of how you encourage them. Be careful of what you would say to them. For example, "Have you found a job yet? What are you doing? How many applications have you sent out this week?" Second injuries are the things that we say to each other, thinking that we're helpful only to the person receiving those words. They are injuries. It's like another wound. It's another battle. It's another source of hurt and pain. So by all means, be careful and be thoughtful. With job loss, there's constant self-deprecating or blaming of others. Shame is a constant presence and easily triggered. People live with the stigma and the social embarrassment of being unemployed. In a country like ours, where we put great importance on degrees and employment, achievements, accolades, what the world has said about you, your position, your status, your job description, only to have all that taken away, and we think it does not matter? Or we simply look at the statistics every week or every month and think, oh, it's only 8.3%. These are people who, when they lose their job, feel disrespected, and they may act in ways towards others that are shaming and blaming and humiliating. Here's what Monica said, 57 years old, a global marketing executive. She said, "I remember feeling inadequate when I was laid off. I remember feeling that I was not good enough, that I would never be good enough, that if this company let me go, no other company on earth would hire me because clearly I wasn't good enough. No one wants me." And we certainly try to dress that up as adults. We will say, we'll find a way, we'll get through this, only to realize that deeper inside, we're struggling with whether or not anybody really wants us. And if you've submitted application after application, resume after resume after resume, 300, 400, 500, and no one calls you back, what else are you going to think? I mean, we know the odds are difficult. We know that many people are competing for one job, depending on the type of job that it is. But it does get to you, and it does undermine the very thing that we need to have to go forward. "I didn't think I had anything to offer. I didn't think that there was anything about me that anybody would value. My self-worth was decimated. I lost all sense of my own value. My self-worth was gone. I didn't believe in myself anymore. I didn't believe that there was anything about me that would be of any value or interest to a potential employer. Scott, who we heard from earlier, said this: the deepest wound was clearly the feeling by my superior that he could get along without me. He didn't need me anymore. There was that natural feeling of, I am a failure. I failed my wife, and in his case, he failed his grandkids. I failed the system. And Norma, 34 years old, single mother, said this: when I was laid off, I felt like the smallest person alive. I had no money. I was about to lose my home. I was feeling lost and didn't know where to go. These are not people who are slackers. They are achievers. They work hard. They want to go places in their life, and they find themselves in a place where they've lost job, they've lost esteem, and they've lost hope. Schema number four, quickly, is the intimacy schema. Intimacy. This is the belief that I have a group of people to belong to. I have a community. I find comfort through the relationships that I'm a part of. I have connections to people who I care about and who care about me. With job loss, you lose that. You lose community. You tend to avoid others. You avoid personal conversations that could bring people emotionally close to you. You feel isolated, lonely. There's grief, there's detachment, and a fear of really connecting with others for fear that they will find out what you're really feeling. People may feel like they have a hard time being alone and understanding their own experience. They may seek to avoid people at all costs. Monica said this: I would go to the lake with my friends and do all the things that I had normally done with my friends, but I always felt inadequate. I always felt that I was being tolerated because clearly they didn't really want me. I was such a failure. I became passive and introspective. Eventually, people kind of pulled back. Nobody ever actually said anything. They just disappeared. Grace, 50 years, a senior executive in a large, big box retailer that you would all recognize, said this: losing your job also means you've lost your friends. Finally, the control schema. This is the belief that says you possess power to control your decisions in your life. Krista, my wife, and I always talk about, we long to believe that we have control, that we can pray control into existence, but the reality is we have no control. But yet it's one of those frames of reference. It's a schema that's powerful. You think you can control your environment, and you do the best that you can, but the reality is you have very little control. With job loss, you are helpless to act on your own behalf. It disrupts your everyday schedule. Feelings of being trapped by someone else is making decisions that affects every aspect of your life. And just one more quote from Pete here, about ready to wrap it up. These feelings of not having control, that's what I think really gets to so many people. It makes me angry. It makes people angry. I know it made me angry. Just feeling like you're not in control. You don't have control. You don't know what's going to happen to you. It was an overall feeling of being unappreciated, almost to the point of being rejected and cheated. I quickly moved from feeling underappreciated and rejected to being cheated and being screwed. The anger set in, quote, damn it. I was treated poorly. Those guys, they screwed me. Just really angry. It was also an anger at myself for letting myself get into this kind of a situation. This led to a lack of esteem and confidence, and it actually got depressing. I mean, I was never really paralyzed to the sense that I couldn't get out of bed, but it certainly influenced my mood in every aspect of my life. I really thought I was screwed forever. It eats at you like a cancer. You're looking for answers. They're not coming, and you think about it more and more and more. Okay, maybe just about 4 or 5 minutes. All right, great. Thanks, Patrick. Okay, those are the significant schemas that have been identified as being vulnerable to disruption when there's a psychological trauma. And again, there's more information here, much, much more that I can even get into, and that's why the bibliography is there for you. So how do we move forward? Well, as I said earlier, we've got to be willing to embrace openness and adjust to life when life demands that we adjust. We have to revise our schemas and change our frames of reference. This is a new world with new economic realities that invite us to change and adapt. It is not the way it used to be. The employment market, jobs, finding a job, getting a job, keeping a job is a new game. requires new strategies, which I'm not qualified to talk about, but it requires that we adapt, that we change, that we adjust. We must be willing to work with greater ambiguity and uncertainty. We must be willing to let go of the need to control and embrace what we can do with the resources that we have. And to struggle to preserve what was really is going to make us more psychologically unhealthy. There's got to be a sense of being able to let go of what we can't control and which is, in fact, changed and gone, and try to understand the new reality of employment and then coping with ourselves and managing our emotions. That's crucial. It's critical. Making adjustments not only relates to the individual, but it also relates to the corporate world. What do businesses, what are they required to do? Businesses, in terms of the ones that do the hiring, need to be more intentional about hiring the millions of men and women who are among the long-term employed. How do they do that? How do they hedge their bets? By creating environments that help rebuild the schemas and frames of reference that have been destroyed by unemployment. And that's a deeper conversation with helping HR departments know how to do that. Peter Capelli, professor of management at the Wharton School and the author of the book, Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, makes the point that businesses must be willing to invest in training that gets people up to speed quickly. They must stop looking for the perfect candidate and look for the good candidate and engage in the kind of training that will get them up to speed quickly. So as we leave today, can we say that the state of unemployment is the new normal? Is this what we should get used to? 8.3% or higher? Well, here's something to think about. In the years since the collapse of 2008, this is by Jonathan Kayat of the New York Magazine, penned this in early August. In the years since the collapse of 2008, the existence of mass unemployment has stopped being something that economic powers even pretend to regard as a crisis. It's something that we get used to, right? I mean, couldn't we say in this room that, hey, you know, it's 15 million people, 20 million people when you add the underemployed? We just got to live with it. But to those directly impacted, the economic crisis is an emergency, a life-altering disaster, the damage from which we will endure, which will endure for years. But for most of those in a position to address it, simply have not seen it in such terms. And for millions and millions of Americans, the economic crisis is the worst event of their lives. They have lost jobs, homes, health insurance, opportunities for their children, seen their skills deteriorate, and lost their sense of self-worth. But from the perspective of those in a position to alleviate the suffering, the crisis is merely a sad and distant tragedy. Let's not become hardened, friends, to this issue. Our employment crisis masks a larger issue. 15 million Americans are in danger of losing their sense of psychological preparedness and fitness, as well as vocational sharpness. To think that we can compete with an economic powerhouse such as China, while a broad swath of our labor force is disintegrating and demoralized, is simply illusory. We cannot do it. We must find a way through this, and we must find a way through this with a sense of urgency. What other solutions? Let's help people get training. That's going to be a continuing issue and an opportunity. Manufacturing jobs are not coming back, including construction jobs. And so new training, new skills are important. Congress must govern. It's the only thing I'm going to get close to when it comes to politics. I'll just say that Congress must govern. The fiscal cliff must be addressed and resolved. The price of indecision and paralysis is being paid by 15 to 20 million Americans every single day. That's the way I see it. That's the way I see a failure to govern. The debt crisis in the European Union must be resolved. And finally, the last thing, Patrick, this is it. Peter Rupert, a professor of economics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, in a New York Times article published recently, just August 16th, said this in reference to the economic decline in the European Union's biggest economies, save Germany, much of which would apply to our own situation. And so here's the final word. Quote, Europe is entering a lost decade, a period of pernicious stagnation, and wasted potential that could have lasting effects on ordinary citizens. Economic growth not realized represents investments in education that were never made, research that was never financed, businesses that failed, and careers that ended too early or never got off the ground. I leave you with the thought that this is an issue that is urgent. It is critical. And wherever you are, whatever station in life that you're in, whether you own a business or you're employed or you're looking for work, there is a way that we can walk alongside of those or be a part of nonprofit opportunities that are making a difference and a dent in people who are trying to salvage something of their life. It not only matters now, but this is something that will make a difference years down the road. So thank you, Patrick. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'll entertain a few questions.
You might point out, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions for Dr. Yeager, there is a microphone right here, or which you don't have to use. You may have so.
Right here. The question, anybody talking about population control with global unemployment issues? Right. That, absolutely. I'm not prepared to respond to that question specifically, but I think the economy is finite and jobs are finite. And I think it does have a great deal to do with population and people that are available for working, for jobs, looking for work. But there's not enough jobs to be had. What's really interesting in the United States is that there are there's 3.6 million jobs that are going unfilled right now. Right now, this very day, 3.6 million. This is reported in the Huffington Post, I think, 2 weeks ago. And yet employers are finding it difficult to find qualified individuals to fill those positions. Well, it's really a two-part issue. One is that businesses will say people aren't qualified. They need more training. And yet there are people who have plenty of training and are qualified, overqualified, who are not being hired. So we have people who are available to work, jobs that they could fill, and corporations that are not hiring them. So we have an issue. The book that I referred to earlier about why good people can't find jobs, that is in the bibliography. And he talks about this in a very simple way that's very helpful. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, as soon as my children entered junior high school, I kept stressing. I said, if you're going to survive in today's economy, you have to have a marketable technical skill. And fortunately, I kept then, they went to computer camp, we did all science projects, et cetera, et cetera. I'm trying to boast maybe, but one's a CEO of an IT company, another one's a... chief of anesthesiology at one of our Bay Area hospitals. But unless people have technical skills to market, they're not going to go anyplace.
Again, great point. There's been a lot of research and a lot of information that you can find if you Googled the discrepancy between where the jobs are. There are a great deal of job offerings at the higher end of the employment bracket, which means people with IT skills, computer skills, technical skills, many, many jobs, many openings. There are many openings and jobs at service levels as well. Not many jobs at that middle. The middle category where typically we'd have middle management, et cetera. So we've seen this gutting of the labor market. We call it structural unemployment, where we've seen the labor market go through drastic changes, which is why now people who are highly qualified would be great middle managers, white-collar, blue-collar managers, supervisors, can't find work because they lack the technical skills. And many of those middle-class jobs have either been outsourced or been computerized. There was a great article in the New York Times yesterday on technology and how technology continues to change the job market with doing so much more than what humans can do. Yeah. Yes. Did y'all hear Michael? Yeah, okay. Have I found in my research that women deal with job loss more effectively, involuntary job loss more effectively than men? Some have called this recession the man session, because males have inordinately taken the greater hit in terms of gender. More men have lost their jobs than women have. Far be it from me to try to address that, Michael. That's a complex question. I will say this. When I was interviewing one of the executives for some research years ago, it was Grace, who was the VP of an executive vice president of HR for a large big box retailer, and I made the comment mistakenly to her that I said, well, I believe that men seem to struggle more with job loss than do women. Not a good thing to say. 5'2", tiny, but just she told me in no uncertain terms that I was wrong, and that there are women who are as equally competitive as men, if not more so, and that for them job loss is just as traumatic. A woman's job loss in a high position, executive leadership, senior management, can be just as difficult as it is for a man. Yes.
I think it's going to be bad for our societies and the future generation with so much, almost too much emphasis on just technology and science. I mean, it's, you know, any society where technology far outruns their wisdom and knowledge, that's actually a dangerous thing. And this is happening with where teachers, you know, they're so important, and artists and other kinds of people. They give understanding and knowledge to people. They're losing their jobs, and schools are closing, and there's so much emphasis on science, technology and healthcare, just people getting sick, and more drugs are constantly being pushed on people. I think these are really bad signs. This is really needs changing, and I don't know when that's going to happen, but I think these are not good indicators.
I would agree. Maybe one more. Do we have time for one more? Okay, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Dr. Uergler. What do you assess in terms of the role of corporate universities in terms of training not only their internal people, but perhaps maybe for a small fee, training people on the outside?
I want to make sure I understand your question. Are you talking, Jeffrey, about apprentice programs, or corporate universities? An example would be? Got it, like an internal university. Okay, right. I think that's wonderful. That is a way of bringing people into the organization. They have their own system in place to get them up to speed, an onboarding process that is outstanding. AT&T and Disney, I mean, goodness, they have the funding to invest in training, and they do a great job of that. So they don't hire perfect people. They hire good people who can develop into perfect managers and perfect supervisors and perfect executives. So they bring people along. It's also a way of shaping them to work in a particular organizational culture that is unique. There are many organizations who have cut back on funding for training. In fact, Capelli says this in his book, that's one of the issues that's driving corporate America's lack of or their unwillingness to hire good people. Rather, they're looking for perfect people because they don't have the funding for training anymore. And so they wait and they wait and they wait. And so many people who would be good fits if they could get onboarded with a little bit of training, they're being left behind. So great point. I think a lot of it has to do with the size and the amount of funding that's available. Okay, very last question, Heinrich.
Yeah, first of all, I really enjoyed your analysis, and I really enjoy the way you kind of look at the different schemas and how you really shake their worldview or the perception of the world when you suffer from job loss. I was curious to hear if you've had an opportunity to look more into what can help these individuals to move on. How do you rebuild your schema to in a constructive way? Is it obviously, if you get a new job, that would help a lot, but is it kind of building on your social network? Is it some kind of coaching? Is it what what helps these people to move on?
Well, I think we have some therapists in the room, counselors, trained psychologists. I'm going to leave it to them. But I think, Heinrich, that I wish I would have had more time to talk about how schemas are rebuilt. That is a complex process. How do you build, reestablish esteem? How do you rebuild the schema of control, trust, safety? That's a great question. It's complex, and I believe it takes time. But I do think that when someone has been traumatized by unemployment, and to understand that experience and why it's so devastating, to begin to focus on rebuilding and redefining yourself. For example, to detach your esteem and your ego from your work. In other words, I'm Jeff Uergler. I'm employed at Golden Gate University. But I'm Jeff Uergler, the man. I'm married to Krista. This is my character, my personality. Oh, by the way, I work at a university in San Francisco. And surely my job means something to me. But doing some more work on separating what really matters, what doesn't, is part of that process. But it is complex, and I would leave that to experts like Patrick to really address that. But great question. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Uergler, I want to thank you very much.